Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. Right now we're going to talk with Peter J. Pitts, who is the president of the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest. That's cmpi.org. We're going to talk about the subject of single-payer health insurance, in other words, nationalized health insurance. He wrote an article recently that was posted in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Peter, thank you for joining us on this program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right. First of all, let's define, have you define, what do people mean when they say single-payer program when they're talking about health insurance?
Well, I think, unfortunately, what people say is quite different from what the reality is. I think when people like Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton say single-payer health care, and then they say free, what they're trying to tell the public is that the government's going to pay for everything. It's going to be great, and that there's no charge for any of it to the individual or the taxpayer. And that's completely untrue, because what single-payer really means is that government runs everything and raises taxes in a way that people would not possibly believe. I mean, the Bernie Sanders plan, for example, which is a single-payer health care plan, is estimated to cost, by his own estimations, about $1.4 trillion a year. That's 10 times more than the Obamacare plans cost right now. Mm. And when a plan like this was raised on the state level in Vermont, which is where, of course, Senator Sanders is from, the governor who initially supported it pulled it back, and he said, and this is a direct quote, that a single-payer system in Vermont would be too great a disruption and risk to small businesses and working families. So even in Vermont, which is a very left-leaning state where the senator comes from, the governor realized this was not going to work, and you know, almost 65% of the population didn't want it, and that's in Vermont. Mm. Now he's trying to present this as a viable program for the whole nation. Another big problem for both Secretary Clinton and for Senator Sanders is that they view the government, that the problem is that there isn't enough government in health care. And my view is that there's already too much government. And when you look at people's problems with the Affordable Care Act, with Obamacare, they're complaining that their choices are limited, they can't get to see a doctor, they're paying more from their copay at the pharmacy. So this isn't a problem of too little government, it's a problem of too much government. And single payer is complete government control, which is, I think, going in radically the wrong direction.
I can't help but think of that old line from P.J. O'Rourke where he said something like, if you think government, or I'm sorry, if you think health care is expensive now, just wait till it's free.
Exactly right. P.J., summed that up a couple of years ago, and what was true then is even truer now, which is when the government gets involved in anything, rarely are things less expensive and more available. Generally speaking, it's completely the reverse. But when you put together programs that combine government purchasing power and free market enterprise, good things happen. And an example of that is the Part D drug benefit, where people on Medicare get their medicines not for free, but at extremely low cost, because the government and private industry has kept this, the one most important piece of the puzzle in place, which is enterprise and competition. And that's exactly what a single-payer healthcare system takes out of the proposition, which is why you see people in Europe, by a very large margin these days, wanting more private options and insurance rather than those that are, strictly speaking, provided by the government.
So when people talk about single-payer insurance, what they're really talking about is the government is that single payer. Now, I've done some studies in, based on, national health care in Canada. And I remember one lady was saying that, and she was Canadian, and she had to come to the United States to seek special treatment. She had to jump out of line. She had to pay for it out of her own pocket, even though she'd been paying through the nose for years in lots of taxes there in Canada. But the one thing she said that shocked me was that their dogs in Canada get better health care, seriously, than human beings do in Canada because of their national health system.
Well, one thing about any type of health care is that it's really great until you need it. If you're healthy, any type of health care system is generally okay. If you need to go to the pharmacy and get an antibiotic for a cold, it doesn't really matter what type of system exists. It's relatively easy to get care. It's when you're in really desperate need for sophisticated 21st century health care where health care systems make a difference. And that's why you don't see a lot of people in other countries going to Europe for their health care. They're coming here to the U.S. And the reason that's true is because a free market system rewards innovation. It makes innovation available. It trains people to deal with innovation so that you're getting the best and the brightest, the most cutting-edge treatments across the board. Now, clearly, you know, cost is an issue, access is an issue, but it's available. When you have a single-payer system, you basically say innovation is too expensive. We don't need it. People need to get bargain basement care. And to my mind, broader access to sub-quality care is not a victory in public health.
Are you familiar at all with Norway in terms of Norway's healthcare system?
Well, you know, I think that Senator Sanders speaks a lot about the Scandinavian system.
Right, and I'm just
look at
Go ahead. I would like your comments on it. I'm just curious.
And if you look at Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, people vote with their feet at the end of the day, right? That's the best metric. And in Scandinavia, 10% and growing of the population is moving from single-payer systems to wanting to buy private healthcare policies. And that isn't because it's a nice thing to do. It's because they feel it's necessary to protect themselves and their family's health.
Right. And in some cases, again, I go back to Canada. I remember there was some legislation where you would be blocked from buying privately funded, you know, health supplemental insurance or whatever. So there are some situations where the government won't even let you do that.
That's right. In fact, Canada tried to do that. I think it was 2 years ago. There was a case in Canada of a woman who wanted to buy private health insurance, and the government said, you can't do that. Everybody has to be in. That's how the system works. And it went to the Supreme Court of Canada, and the Canadian Supreme Court ruled that it was a basic human right for an individual to have the ability to buy their own private health care. So in Canada, you know, in many ways, philosophically very close to where we are here, the courts ruled the ability to buy private insurance a human right. And for governments in Europe and in Western Europe to deny that just speaks to how desperate some of these government systems are.
Yeah. In England, how about a comment about England and their socialized medicine, which they've had, I guess, since the days of Clement Attlee, you know, right at the tail end of World War II?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, the National Health Service in England is often held up as kind of a crown jewel of that country's, you know, way to do business. But at the end of the day, it's a great example, again, of unless if you're not seriously ill, any system gets the job done. You know, the NHS regularly rations care, you know, has significant lines, you know, queues for people to get care that isn't easily delivered. Doctors don't like it. Nurses don't like it. Hospitals don't like it. They game the system. And the person that gets left out is the patient. You know, doctors, nurses, hospitals all lobby, you know, for higher pay. Of course, they are government employees. And the people who, at the end of the day, get poor, rationed care for which they've got to get online, you know, is the average citizen. You know, when you look at cure rates and cancer recovery rates and tumor reduction, any metric you want to look at for success, you know, single-payer systems rank low. You know, people are always keen to say, well, you know, the U.S. has a higher rate of infant mortality, for example. And it's a classic example of numbers telling you what you want them to say, because in many of these single-payer systems, if a child is born prematurely and does not survive, that child is not even counted as a live birth.
Right.
In this country, we count those children as live births. And as a result, we save many children who would never previously have been saved. So, you know, the numbers that, you know, people like Michael Moore dredge up, you know, as they say, are true but not accurate. They paint a misleading picture.
Mm-hmm.
And again, people vote with their feet. You know, people are coming here for those types of treatments, for that type of care, because single payer systems, at the end of the day, really focus on saving the government money in the short term, in a budget cycle, rather than the long term care of the patient.
If I'm not mistaken, as far as Michael Moore, doesn't he hold up Cuba or whatever as a positive example in contrast to the United States?
That was one of my favorite things that he ever said, that Cuba has got better health care than the U.S. And, you know, my view is, again, you know, people can look at an issue and they can disagree, but if Mr. Moore feels that's true, and since we now have diplomatic relations with Cuba, I think he should open up a medical tourism business for Americans going to Cuba, and I think he should invest every cent he's got to show how confident he is that that's going to work out.
Wow. All right, we're talking right now with Peter J. Pitts, president of CMPI.org. CMPI stands for Center for Medicine in the Public Interest. Basically, when it comes to healthcare, one size does not fit all, and that's the problem with government schemes to take over more and more of our healthcare system, correct?
Yes, exactly right. I mean, the government does many things well. You know, providing instructions to doctors about how to practice medicine is not going to be one of them. You know, running hospitals, you know, they do a very poor job running the VA hospitals. You want them to run every hospital? You know, we have a problem keeping doctors in practice now because they feel that too much of the art of medicine is being directed to them by the government. We want them to work for the government, to get their paychecks from the government. That is somehow going to increase a doctor's verve and excitement for staying in the practice of medicine. I don't think so. It'll have the opposite effect. I think one of the other unintended consequences of trying to move more towards government-controlled healthcare is you're going to drive practitioners out of the practice of medicine. And that's a hugely important thing to consider, considering that we're already facing physician shortages.
Well, how do we transition from Obamacare to a more humane system of healthcare?
Good question. I mean, I don't know whether Obamacare should be revoked or fixed, but I do know that we've got to move forward, and we have to have a plan. And I believe that any plan that has any chance of success has to realize one thing, which is that you can't solve the problem in a year, 2 years, 5 years, nor can you budget in 1, 2, 3, 4 year increments. You have to realize that the best way to save money and provide proper service is to think relative to the long-term condition of the patient. If we can get a patient better, faster, with more innovative care sooner, which is going to cost, you know, money, obviously, it's a great long-term investment. But governments don't think in terms of the life of the patient. They think in terms of politics, political election cycles, in terms of budget cycles. We have to start thinking in terms of patient cycles, a patient's life. That's one thing. The second thing is we need to realize that if we don't reward innovation, it's going to go away. And that's a bad proposition, not only for the public health, but for the economy. I mean, you know, innovation drives tens of thousands of jobs, you know, high-paying, well-educated jobs, and they'll go someplace else. These jobs, if you'll recall, used to be exclusively in Europe until maybe 30 years ago, when they began to put really significant constrictions on, you know, companies' ability to do business. We've got that business here now. We need to keep it here. You don't get innovation in a doctor's office in a hospital unless you're willing to pay for it. Are we willing to say right now we're going to reduce costs and say we're not going to have any more innovation from now until the end of time? Now, the other big problem is we're looking for people to blame. That's a political soundbite. We need to all work together to get to the right place. Unfortunately, in an election cycle, I don't know what you can do because that's kind of the nature of the beast, politicians want to offer simplistic solutions to complex problems. It plays well. You know, to say, well, it's complicated, well, it's going to take a long time, people don't want to hear that. But realistically, that's really the path forward.
You know, it's interesting. If I were to take a transcript of this interview and just, you know, look for the word innovation, it appears throughout. And certainly innovation is expensive at first. But, you know, you think about how long and how much money did it take through innovation, you know, create some sort of serum or whatever. The first pill might have cost, you know, a fortune because of the research and development. But then afterwards, and after it causes a lot of good things, then it's mass produced and, you know, and eventually it cheapens over time. So innovation may be expensive at first, yes. And then there's trial and error, of course. But still, over time, it, as you say, it not only saves lives, but it could even we could see the costs go down over time as it's mass produced.
That's exactly right. And also, the thing about innovation is it comes through billions and billions of dollars of failure. And
yep.
We learn from failure.
Yep.
But people don't realize you've got to factor that into how these things happen. People think, the other thing people think is, well, you know, in the U.S., doesn't the government invent all these drugs and drug companies just kind of market them? Not so. I mean, people like Elizabeth Warren seem to think that all the innovations come from NIH funding.
Right.
Not true. Again, people are trying to draw good guys and bad guys and score political points off of it, And that, I don't really believe, is helpful at all.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, Peter J. Pitts, again, president of the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest. People could read your articles, I assume, including this one that posted in the Philadelphia Inquirer at cmpi.org, correct?
That's right, and we invite everybody to join our conversation.
All right. Hey, thank you so much for being with us. All the best to you. Okay.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.